This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you. Welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our, our 58th program in our series dealing with Muhammad, the last messenger of Allah. Our second program discussing the early Meccan period. I'm very pleased to have joining me on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Could you very quickly summarize the main points that we touched on when we began our discussion of this early Meccan period in our last program?
Sure, very briefly. We continued the discussion in the very beginning about the claim of prophethood, and more particularly the issue of the parallels that might be there between the Quran and the other religious literature, especially the Bible. And we indicated that the parallels actually indicate that the source of revelation to all of these prophets is the same, rather than one of them copying from the others. But most of the program actually dealt with the examination and analysis of the Meccan period, and more particularly the beginning of embracing of Islam on the part of people within the household of the prophet. We mentioned Khadija, his wife, being the first, then his cousin Ali, then his adopted son at that time, Zayd. And outside of the household, we spoke briefly about Abu Bakr, his close friend. And in each of these four cases, we try to explain the significance and the symbolical meaning of their embracing of Islam.
Mm-hmm. During our discussions, you mentioned that Abu Bakr succeeded in persuading a number of other people to join Islam. Many of them turned out to be among the more prominent Muslim leaders. Can you give us some names and perhaps explain if they had anything in common?
Sure. The first group after this first four actually included some prominent people, including Uthman, who happened to be elected as the third caliph after the Prophet, and other very famous names that we might come to later in the coverage of Islamic history, like Abdurrahman ibn Awf, Zubair ibn al-Awwam, Talha ibn Ubaidullah, and Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas. After this group of five, then came a number of people, some of whom belonged to the family of the Prophet, some were from outside. Among those from within the family of the Prophet was Ja'far, son of Abu Talib, who was a cousin of the Prophet, as well as Ja'far's wife. But outside of that, there were Asma and Aisha, the two daughters of Abu Bakr. And by the way, I'd like to make a side remark here. In a previous program, when we dealt with the marriages of the Prophet and his marriage to Aisha, we discussed some of the various reports as to how old she was when the Prophet married her.
Yes.
Now, these reports that we find about Aisha becoming Muslim in the very early period, which is the first 3 years of the mission of the Prophet, indicates that she must have been at least 16 years old when she married the Prophet. Because after that initial 3 or 4 years, there was another 10 years in Mecca, and she was married to the Prophet, or the marriage was consummated only after he went to Medina. So she must have been at least at the age of 5 or 6 to be able to understand Islam or accept it. So 6 plus 10 seemed to indicate that she probably was 16. That's an interesting remark, that even though a lot of people wrote about this, I didn't notice that anyone picked on that issue and tried to correlate it to the age of Aisha. But this is just, like I said, is a side remark that I found interesting. In addition to this, there were other people also who became quite famous also in Islamic history. There was Fatima, the sister of Umar, who, after he became Muslim, he became the second caliph after the Prophet. And her husband, Sa'id ibn al-Musayyib, and his friend, Khabbab ibn al-Arat. There were also people who were not necessarily very prominent, like the family of Ibn Yasir, including Yasir, Sumayya, his wife, who was the first martyr to die for the sake of Islam, and Ammar, their son. There were other famous people also, some people like Abu Ubaidah ibn al-Jarrah, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, who turned later on to be one of the most famous narrators of hadith and jurist, he was a very good jurist. Al-Arqam ibn al-Arqam, in whose house the Prophet for some time, as we'll see later, used to meet with his companions in the early days. It included Suhaib, who was actually a Roman fellow, who was not even from the tribe of Quraysh. As far as the main characteristic of those people, age-wise, some scholars noted that most of them were either younger than the Prophet or about the same age of the Prophet, which was at that time about 40 years. Why? A possible reason is that in a tribal society like this, changing of one's religion was not really looked upon very favorably, especially when you get older, so that might become very difficult for them. So usually it's the younger people who are more responsive to that. As far as the tribes from which they came, well, they have a cross-section coverage of various clans. In fact, the clan that was closest to the Prophet, Bani Hashim, did not have too many who embraced Islam.
Yes.
On the contrary, actually, Abu Lahab, who was the uncle of the Prophet, according to some historians, two of his sons were engaged to the two daughters of the Prophet. But after the Prophet, you know, started to preach Islam, he asked his sons to break the engagement with the daughters of the Prophet. And in the opinion of Rajih al-Kurdi, he says that this shows that the mission of the Prophet and the relationship with those who embraced Islam was far more than just a relationship of clan or family, because he was persecuted most by his closest, by some of his closest relatives. There's another observation also about the early people who embraced Islam. Like I said, not all of them come from the noble tribes. So it included, for example, Suhaib, who was a Persian fellow, I mean a Roman fellow, and others. And finally, it might be observed also that according to most historians, they say that the number of people who embraced Islam in the nearly 3 to 4 years of the initial Meccan period was not very much, really. It goes anywhere between about 40 to less than 60.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of all that effort.
A very small number.
Yeah.
Why, in your view, was such a small number accepted Islam during this entire period? Do you have any views on that?
Well, of course, there could be some reasons which might be common with all prophets, that when the Prophet comes, he faces people with teaching, with revelation, which might be different from the kind of customs and habits and traditions which those people inherited from their predecessors. And that might be particularly applicable in the case of Arabia as a tribal society. The question of tribal loyalty, following,
yes,
you know, the norms of the tribe, was very, very, very strong. And we will talk about that further, perhaps, when we come to the analysis of opposition to the Prophet in later times. Another possible reasons, again, is that these early followers of the Prophet,
yes,
small in number as they may be, represented really a very important nucleus, which later on carried the major burden and responsibility and offered all kinds of sacrifice to support the new faith. And as such, it was very important for this nucleus to inculcate the faith in their heart, to deepen their commitment to God, to Allah. This was very crucial, much more important than sheer numbers.
Yes.
In the beginning, at least, that was very essential, the quality. Two more observations on this that Dr. Al-Bouti suggests is that some Orientalist non-Muslim writers try to explain the phenomenal success of Islam, at least as time went on, by saying that the Arabs were at a stage where they were really ready for this logical and simple message of monotheism that the Prophet brought. But again, he said that if that were true, Why is it that only such a few people embraced Islam in a span of 3 to 4 years?
Yes.
If the Arabs were really ready, ripe for the message, you would expect a larger number to flock to Islam, even though there could be other reasons for opposition. The other observation also he adds is that there should be a distinction between the duty to convey the message, to preach the faith on one hand, and the use of judgment in the selection of the proper strategy or means of communication, depending on the circumstances of time, place, and the surrounding environment. There may be cases, for example, where the public proclamation may be delayed for a little while, at least on the part of the followers, or the confrontation with the forces that try to stop them. That should be related to the context of the time in which they're living. So at times there may be a necessity to avoid unnecessary confrontation. That's as far as the Muslim themselves, the new Muslims, and maybe that's why they try to keep a low profile. But as far as the Prophet himself, it's obvious that from the very beginning he was engaged actually in confronting the people with the new message. His role as a prophet.
Well, given that in these early stages, particularly there was a need for some secrecy, how did the early Muslims go about practicing their faith?
Well, there are some historical narrations, especially you find that in Ibn Hisham, others, that, for example, whenever they wanted to pray together, sometimes they used to go out in the desert. Sometimes they pray in a small group, at times individually. There have been cases, as Sa'id ibn Zayd narrates, that they would meet in a house and close the door and just worship so that they would not be harassed by the unbelievers. There are some incidents, however, that seems to indicate that some of them were caught praying, if that term can be used. And sometimes skirmishes took place between the Muslims, the early Muslims, and the pagans. Ibn Hisham, for example, mentioned a number of them. He said, for example, in one instance, Sa'd, the son of Waqqas, went with a number of Muslims to one of the, you know, passages in Mecca outside the city itself. So a number of pagans passed by them. They expressed dismay towards those Muslims for praying in a different way. They scolded them. They criticized them. So an argument took place between both groups. It resulted even in actual fighting between them, in which one of the unbelievers, one of the pagans, was injured. In another occasion narrated in another historical reference, it says that the Prophet once went out with a group of Muslims, and they prayed, two together or one separately, just in a small setting. And while two Muslims were praying, some of the unbelievers passed by. They abused them, they stoned them until they finished their prayer, and then they left them. It is possibly because of some of those reasons, as some scholars suggest, that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, advised Muslims to take, you know, or play a low key in their faith. They should hide a little bit, stay home, and maybe take a period of cooling off, so that they would not necessarily be in conflict with others, just to avoid physical confrontation. Some even say that at one point the Prophet, peace be upon him, and some of his followers used to go to the house of Al-Arqam, the one we mentioned among the early Muslims, Al-Arqam, the son of Al-Arqam also, and stayed there for some time, just by way of cooling off, probably.
How long did this period of cooling off, or perhaps staying in the hideout, the house of Al-Arqam, how long did this continue?
Well, there have been some variations in reports as to the length of that period. Some put it at as long as 1 month. There are questions as to whether this was a continuous period of stay, or was it intermittent, that they meet sometimes during the day for prayers, learning about Islam, doing the prayers or reciting the Quran. According to Dr. Imaduddin Khalil, he says that after sifting through these reports, he believes that this period or this stay in the house of Al-Arqam as a quiet or isolated house took place probably towards the end of the third year of the mission of the Prophet or the very beginning of the fourth year of that mission. But the historian seems to agree that this was in a place whereby people could go, people who wish to listen about or to know about Islam without harassment and yes. pressure from others, they could go without intimidation. Some even report that some of the visitors to Mecca, strangers, passers-by, who heard about Islam, they used also to go to that house so that they might meet someone who might explain to them what Islam is all about. In any case, this period essentially was a period of avoiding direct confrontation with the non-believers, with the pagans in particular.
Mm-hmm. It's rather interesting, this period of secrecy, how in your view does it relate to the situation that many Muslims find themselves in today?
I think it's an issue which is of interest and has some application to Muslims living in as minorities, especially in the Western world in particular. You're quite right. It relates also to the situation of Muslims in Muslim countries.
Yes.
And mind you, it's well known that many Muslims in the so-called Muslim countries do not have the religious freedom as Muslims,
yes.
even though their rulers are Muslims by name. And many of the Muslim countries, as we all know, are ruled by dictators under
yes.
different titles. And in a situation like that, especially the latter one,
yes.
It might be useful to make a distinction between courage, between being steadfast in saying the truth and not compromising one's principles and convictions on one hand, which is the first step towards assimilation if you compromise on principles.
Yes.
On the other hand, one also should keep in mind the necessity of caution and wisdom, avoiding unnecessary violence, which is consonant with the spirit of Islam in its teaching generally, that whenever it's possible to avoid violence and confrontation, there's no need for that. There's no absolute requirement for that. Especially in the case of Muslims who are resisting or opposing dictators with very limited resources. Muslims might be small in number, ill-equipped, and as such, to get involved in confrontation with those tyrannical rules and rulers at one point when they are not strong enough to stand up to this, could be more harmful, could do more harm than good, really, because it could result in the early abortion
yes.
of their movement
yes.
before it even reaches the age of viability, just like yes. when the child or the baby is born very early before the age of viability,
yes.
it may not survive.
Mm-hmm.
So to avoid this early abortion, especially on the part of those who get disturbed, to know that there is a group who stand against their authority and their dictatorship, who speak the truth, which stand against their falsehood, obviously they would try to resist by all means. And this is a matter, in fact, that relate to what the scholars call as-siyasa al-shar'iyya,
yes.
a matter of Islamic jurisprudence pertaining to the selection of the proper strategy, which are more close to the spirit of Islamic teaching and its objectives in life in general.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be useful to elaborate more on this last point that you mentioned, that is on the relationship of the strategy to the Islamic jurisprudence. Could you do that?
Sure. There have been lots of writings on this. One of the best that summarized that as it relates to the situation of early Muslims was suggested by Dr. Muhammad Saeed Ramadan Al-Bouti. And basically says that the consensus among Muslim scholars and jurists is that if Muslims at any particular point of time were few in number and lacking in resources in such a way that it is not very likely that they would be victorious in any confrontation with the enemy, that it might be easier for the enemies or for the dictators to just finish them off, then in that case, they are not supposed to engage in that confrontation prematurely.
Yes.
The jurisprudential foundation of this is that, as the great scholar Al-Mawardi puts it, he says that the general objectives of Islamic law and jurisprudence in general is the preservation of faith, preservation of life, preservation of mind, preservation of honor, and preservation of property, and perhaps in that order of priority. Now, he says then that if you get two of those objectives of Sharia, the preservation of faith by struggling, saying the word of truth, resisting tyranny, which is all right, I mean, that's one objective. And you have another objective, which is preservation of life, preservation of the lives of those few Muslims. And then he says, when the preservation of religion is probabilistic, it's not certain. In other words, the whole group could perish and yes, still the faith would not benefit. So when the preservation of faith, even though it takes priority, is probabilistic, then there is no sense then of sacrificing so many lives for this.
Yes.
And as such, even though the preservation of life comes next to preservation of faith, it took precedence when there is this probability, when it's not certain. Okay. Al-Izz ibn Abd al-Salam, another Muslim jurist, explained that also by saying that if the few believers who are firm in their faith and ready to sacrifice their life, that's fine. But if they fight the forces of unfaith or tyranny under these circumstances, the circumstances where the victory will not be possible at all, even under the circumstances, then the actual result of that confrontation would be the killing and subduing of the believers, which might give more pride and more arrogance to the forces of tyranny, and that would not be very beneficial. Al-Butri comment on this, and he says, actually, it's not the idea of preservation of the lives of the individuals vis-a-vis preservation of faith, because he says that the preservation of the lives of the few believers who are not yet in this period or the stage of viability is in itself preservation of faith. Because he says if the only few believers who are really committed, who carry something good that would benefit mankind, if they are finished and killed, it's not that they lost their lives,
yes,
but that his faith itself would be hurt,
yes,
because nobody else with that understanding, with that commitment, would stand up after their death to offer it to mankind. So the interest is not just personal interest for their own lives, but interest also of the for the faith itself. In brief, then, basically what we're saying, that if avoiding confrontation at one stage, even by keeping silent on some of the wrong that's taking place, taking a low profile in the face of very severe tyranny might be productive, at least in a given stage, then this is the action that should be taken. People should not rush into a rash action that would hurt them and hurt others and hurt the cause of faith,
yes,
ultimately. So that probably was the case of Muslims in this early stage. So mm-hmm. I think it's a very interesting consistency and application of how Islamic law relates to the practical issues like this.
Yes. On that note, I'd like to perhaps have you comment once again on how, in your view, this might have some applicability or to the situation of Muslims living in North America or, for that matter, in the West generally.
Mm-hmm.
What would you comment on that respect?
Okay, I'm glad that you brought that up, because it seemed that my answer to the previous question was mostly either too general or dealing with the situation of Muslims living under dictatorial rule.
Yes.
But I'm glad to say that fortunately for Muslims who are living even as a small minority in Canada, in the US or Western Europe or many other similar countries, They might be small in number, but they have the full freedom to practice their faith. They have the full freedom to speak up and share their faith with others. I mean, this program could be one example of this. Giving this kind of openness in societies where they're living, at least to the extent of being able to practice and talk about their faith, I don't see any point, really, of any Muslim trying to hide his or her identity as a Muslim. Not only hide, I mean, it might be even incumbent on the person to share it with others, to talk to others about it, and to inculcate good relationship with their neighbors, with their colleagues or fellow citizens at work, in schools, and other contexts, but without losing their identity as Muslim, without trying to hide it or feel ashamed of it, which unfortunately is the case with some Muslims who still feel or could not overcome the sort of feeling that they had when they were living in a Muslim country under a certain dictatorial type of rule. They should realize that that situation is different.
Yes.
To be overly cautious under that circumstance, under these circumstances, and to try to hide one's identity might reflect not really the caution and wisdom that other scholars were talking about when I addressed the previous question. It might reflect unnecessary fear, more concern gaining approval of people rather than getting the approval and pleasure of the Creator, of God. It might reflect the fear of for jobs or possessions or other things that should not be the main determinant of their position. They have a duty to fulfill. They have a mission. And when God blessed them with such a society where these freedoms are guaranteed, I think they should not keep hiding. Let me just give an example of some of this attitude that I found rather unfortunate. I'm just give a scenario, may or may not apply to one particular case or the other, but it might reflect this attitude of unnecessary fear. We all know that in Islam, partaking any alcoholic beverage is forbidden. And by analogy, of course, anything that relates to intoxication or beclouding the mind, like, you know, drugs or cocaine or others. Now, if a Muslim, for example, is in a position where he is invited or with a company, in a company of other people who are not Muslims, who find it or believe that it's all right to drink in moderation, and somebody says, all right, he offers him a drink, alcoholic drink. Well, unfortunately, those who cannot distinguish between the use of wisdom and between declaring their identity without offending others might give a very apologetic answer. No thanks, I don't drink. It's too strong for me. So somebody comes back and says, how about a beer? That's light. It's only 10% alcohol. And then you find himself caught in the dilemma and say, I really don't like to have Coke. I prefer something else. I don't like to have beer.
Yes.
And then somebody say, why not? I mean, you said that's strong, but this is not very strong. You see, once you get into this apologetic answers, which is unnecessary, there's no need for that. There's no fear to say what you believe. Then the person gets into a vicious circle, and it could actually lead to answers which are not really a truthful type of answers. So what I'm saying, basically, to apply that to a situation like that, one can still remain courteous, does not have to compromise his principle, and can still speak why he does not wish to have alcoholic drink. If I were in that situation, I would say simply, thank you very much. I don't drink. And I wouldn't even, I would go beyond that even. I said, because I'm a Muslim, it's related to my religious belief. I'd rather take juice or pops or something else, punch, whatever, provided the punch, of course, doesn't have alcohol in it. Well, actually, I find in my own experience, and maybe many other people also, men and women who have been in that situation, if they do it in courtesy, in confidence, without hiding their identity, people even may ask them, well, tell me more about that religion that, you know, yes, prohibit alcoholic drinks or intoxication, and that would be a good chance to share with others. So I think it does have application also even for Muslims in the West as well.
Indeed. Brother Jamal, thank you for today's program. I want to thank you all for watching and invite you back next week when we will continue with our series. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.